Hello, now is Nuevo.
Yes, hello ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Articulate Warbling with Zach
and Laura.
And today we shall be reviewing
Tenet.
That is Tenet, if anyone got confused. And we shall also be reviewing
Truth or Dare,
alongside another Jeff Wadlow film, Fantasy Island, All About Time. We will also be talking about our experience rewatching Paranormal Activity 3. We'll also have a little bit of miscellany, as usual, throughout these Articulate Warbling episodes. We'll also dedicate this episode to the passing, the sad, sad passing of Chadwick Boseman. Wakanda forever, brother. Wakanda forever. Actually, it should be Boseman forever. Anyway, let's get on with the show. So, what is up first? Tenet. Get it?
Rabbit?
Get it, dear.
I think we should start with our ratings and then and then go into why. So, Tenet, rate it.
1 star.
What did I say? Did I say 1 or did I say 2?
You said 1.
Did I?
Yeah.
I can't remember. Okay, 1 star. Why, Zach, did you rate Tenet 1 star? Your almost all-time favourite director, Christopher Nolan, 1 star film, why?
There's no reason behind it. There's no purpose behind it. It's self-indulgent. It's
just to be
self-flagellating.
Clear, he means the film, not his rating. There's no meaning behind it. It's self-indulgent. No, no.
No, no. Not, no.
Not your rating,
no.
The film. You'd think I was the diabetic, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
But isn't it clever and just sci-fi?
Fuck off with that shit. You go see a sci-fi movie, you don't understand what's going on, but you have an out because it's sci-fi, and all sci-fi is so dense and so intellectual and so this, so that. Isn't that the point of sci-fi? No! You've got to have a crux. You've got to have that centre and everything else surrounding it. It's nothing. Tenet is nothing. It's overindulgent. My honest opinion and truth is Christopher Nolan has worked, and he's reflected back. He's literally reflected back and he's gone, "Oh, well, I've not really had a vacation. You know what? I'm going to have a vacation to at least 10 different locations, and I'm just going to write a movie around it." Listen, a good idea is a good idea.
Executing it is a different story.
Is a different story. I love Nolan. I am unashamedly, wholeheartedly fanboy of Nolan. The last episode, I went ranting and raving about anyone who picked up on Christopher Nolan. It picked up on the discussion of Nolan as a fad and as a fashion. I'm not going along this vein. I'm still a fan of Christopher Nolan.
You know, you haven't used the word rant in a very long time. Like, the name of this podcast is not a rant, it's Articulate Warbling.
Well, no, it isn't. Not anymore. It's Articulate Warbling with Laura and Zach. Zach and Laura. You're not before me! It's Zach and Laura!
Look, alphabetically, it's Laura and Zach.
Yeah, and DB has just noticed that.
And also, women come first. Look,
you've completely just like thrown me now. You cut me in, you bitch. No, I don't know what
look,
I was saying.
I mean, okay, so if you look at Inception and you look at Interstellar, both the films that we've watched very recently, they are complicated in an amazing wow way. They, like, you watch it and you're like, what the fuck? But you actually realise how dense and how clever the story is. But with Tenet, I got lost. And not because I'm dumb. Because if anybody's going to get lost, you're going to get lost in Inception, right? And I got
that. Or the last 40 minutes of Interstellar. Or the whole of The Prestige.
But I didn't. So I'm not dumb. At the moment. It was a well thought idea. But it wasn't well thought out in the execution. It wasn't complicated in a wow, that's
it wasn't
awesome way.
It wasn't complicated enough.
Also, it went back on itself, and continuity error just all in that film, wasn't it?
Well, narratively, storytelling-wise, and thematically, continuity just not in the sense of gaffes on the filmmaking behalf, but gaffes on the narrative half. They give you exposition upon exposition upon exposition about something, basically screaming at you what it is. 5 minutes down the line, they contradict themselves.
But it's like, don't look at yourself, because it will ruin you. And then what do the people do? They see themselves.
Don't come into contact with yourself, and then there will be that grandfather. Then they go into the grandfather effect, cause and effect, if you killed your grandfather, blah, 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 as filler, maybe to divert your gaze. I think a lot of exposition is put there. I think instead of Nolan going back and going, okay, I need to rethink this, he's just adding layer upon layer of something just to almost distract you from the faults that are inherent in the movie.
The thing is, though, there was part of it where I was like, oh, this is clever. Like, I was starting to get into it, and I was like, oh, this is actually really quite clever. Oh, this is interesting. What are the consequences? Guess what? There are no fucking consequences. Robert Pattinson had the worst problem with his accent.
No, he didn't.
He did.
He didn't.
He did.
That was Aaron Taylor-Johnson.
No, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, that was just awful. Robert Pattinson decided to slip between English, British, and American.
No, I didn't hear American once. It was British.
I did.
It was all British from my end.
Well, I was listening to him and I'm like, this isn't going too well. Look, he's played in Harry Potter as a British person. He did well. He's played in Twilight as an American person. He did well. But this was like a cross between and it sounded shit. Aaron Taylor-Johnson is a whole nother story. I love him because I think he's beautiful and I think his voice is really, really yummy until he tries to put on this London / Texan accent. He's like the new Rebecca Ferguson.
Yes. And you all know, ladies and gents, from listening to this podcast, that we are a huge fan of Rebecca Ferguson. Now, we need to lay down the line with this. Just because we don't like this movie doesn't mean we hate Christopher Nolan as a person or as a filmmaker. But personally, for me as a fan, I've seen this coming. I did not like Dunkirk. Didn't like it at all. Hollow. Though it is a big event and it's all patriotic, you've got to realise there's not much patriotism when it comes to British people and war. We're kind of like, it shouldn't have happened. We don't like it. Where Americans are like, yee-haw, we're going to fight for our country. Christopher Nolan is British, but he spent enough time in America to have that Americanization. It's almost like that patriotism that he translated into Dunkirk. Dunkirk was hollow, and I felt that he was going away from a direction. He was basically mapping it out, going, what genre haven't I tackled yet? Mm. War. War makes Oscars. And guess what? His first directed nomination, what was it for? Dunkirk.
I think the problem is, as British people, we're not particularly passionate, are we, when it comes to war?
Mm-mm.
Like you say, Americans are very like, yeah, let's fight for our country. And don't get me wrong, we're not sitting here saying, yeah, whatever. But we're very noble, we don't want to be considered to be heroes, we just fight for our country because that's what we need to do.
And
we
just get it over and done with. It's inherently, we're ashamed of it.
We get, as a nation, we feel
and
guilty.
And as our British Empire.
Yeah, but we feel guilty for what we've done, the people we've killed.
Yeah, the Nolan, the whole point of that is, I saw it coming, Nolan was now switching, going, I'm Christopher Nolan. I'm Christopher Nolan. He's realising his celebrity and his name now. Now, it's gone from Christopher Nolan, the visionary director, to Christopher Nolan, the revolutionary director? What revolution's he fucking started? What the fuck does that mean? Revolutionary in what sense? He hasn't revolutionised anything. You all right?
I think that was karma.
What?
I think me bitching upon Tenet meant that I got, like, milkshake in my bloody eye.
It's... Oh, I forgot where I'm going again. Basically, I've seen this coming. It's just a hollowness. Dunkirk was centred upon the technique, the playing of time, the different differentiations, the cinematic worth, the execution, the editorial malarkey. I think that Nolan doesn't get enough credit for his previous films. That there's a lot of heart. There's a lot of emotion. Of emotion.
I wanted to be thrown in every direction with Tenet. Like I was with Inception. Like I was with Interstellar. I never saw Dunkirk because it just didn't interest me at the time. And I wasn't in this kind of phase of watching films because I wanted to kind of analyse it and critique it. But there's a lot of emotion in most of his films, but Tenet was just like, I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel anger. I didn't feel like that tension that you're supposed to feel when it's like, oh shit, he's sin himself. What's going to be the consequence?
Oh shit, this woman. We're meant to pine for this woman and her relationship with her child.
Why couldn't
we? We spend 30 seconds of her saying, hi son, bye son. Give us more. So we're willing for her to be with her son.
Yeah, exactly. There was just nothing.
No romance, no chemistry between David W. Washington and this actress who really looks like Evan Rachel Wood. It's very hollow. And I think it's big ideas, big set pieces, but they don't make a movie. And a movie written around it. Or Nolan is returning to science fiction. I think Nolan is very aware of his celebrity and his name in Hollywood. He is respected. He is passionate. He is a great filmmaker, and he's gone into this knowing that no matter what he makes now, people will go see it in the masses.
I think this is the problem, is he's got himself into a situation where he has a lot of fans, and he knows that fans will watch his film and go, or he thinks, and mostly people
and
will,
the studios.
But mostly people will, they go, oh my god, it's a Christopher Nolan film. Of all films that I've ever seen that have come out, this one is the one where I've heard the most about directors. A lot of people don't hear about the directors. They don't talk about them. They don't really care. But when it came to Tenet, so many people were like, it's a Christopher Nolan film. And I'm like, hang on a minute. Mm. So you go and see, what, 10 films a year or whatever you do.
Mm.
And you don't once say, oh, it's a Danny Boyle film. Or, oh, it's a this film or a that film. It's by this director.
It's a Jeff Wadlow film.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A Matthew Vaughn film.
You never
yeah.
hear that. But when it came to Tenet, everyone was like, it's a Christopher Nolan film. And it's like, how is it?
Because it's screamed at you in the marketing. Even if you haven't got a relationship with Nolan, they're like, it's a Christopher Nolan film. He's a revolutionary. He's changed cinema.
Exactly.
Changed cinema in what sense?
But I think the problem is,
he's made great movies. He has done really clever things, but revolutionised it?
But I think the problem is the fact that everybody's like, it's a Christopher Nolan film. And then they forget that because...
Full stop. That's it.
They forget that because it's a... Because it's a Christopher Nolan film, that means it can't possibly be anything but amazing. It's true.
Mm.
They're like, I'm a fan of Christopher Nolan. Well, I'm sure you are. But the issue I have with that is that you can't then walk into every one of his films and go, that was amazing, without actually genuinely looking at it and going, is that good?
Yeah.
And I had a conversation with a family member recently, and I said, okay, remember Inception, remember Interstellar. She couldn't really remember Interstellar. I tried to give her a synopsis. It didn't work. I said, now compare it to Tenet. And she went, yeah, I suppose. But still, Tenet was really good.
Well, the thing is, we're not saying that you shouldn't not like it.
No, I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is people can't see past the fact that it's a Christopher Nolan film.
Yeah, and can't see past that it's a science fiction movie and this is how it's meant to be.
Exactly.
No, it's not meant to be that. The film, there's no consistency. Also, for a 149-minute movie, it's very fast-paced. I have an issue. There is no pause for breath. There is no space for characters to collect themselves and for those moments
for us to feel.
Exactly. You need those gaps. But this is a spy film. That's not a spy film. It's a science fiction film. It's a Cold War reference, Armageddon, potential World War III film. It's ideas after ideas after ideas and not executed and not all that interesting because we haven't got characters we're engaged with. Also, visually, I think Nolan was a bit lazy. You go in and there's this reverse world. You are going forward in a reverse world, whilst on the other end of it, you're going backwards and a forward thing. I like that notion, but visually, it's demonstrated with a couple of sequences. David Washington puts his foot in a puddle. It goes... There's a car chase sequence, very lacklustre and short-lived, where a car spins in reverse. That's it. The thing is, with Nolan, he can execute grandiose-scale things.
See, that worked well, actually. You know when the first time they come across that car that's in the middle of the road and it spins? But it's driving itself, it's empty.
Mm.
But then when he goes back,
he's
driving that car.
That's just normal continuity errors.
So it's like, actually, he did well with that, because the whole point is that you can't see yourself, but then you can see yourself. So it completely fucked itself over and over again.
No, they can see themselves. They just tell you not to come into contact.
I know, but my problem is that car, the first time
we saw it,
it's
just a continuity error. It's just a continuity error.
Yeah, but it's
because
full of
it's
continuity
a stunt.
Errors.
Well, Nolan is notorious for his continuity. I like the semblance that everything was done without the usual CGI bomb thrown in the mix. I like that everything was done as Nolan is notorious for, but everything that this film is being notarised for, hardly any CGI, old-fashioned tricks. Nolan has applied all of these traits to all of his previous films. Why are you focusing in and honing in on this specific film being the emblem of that? Interstellar worked with hardly any green screen. It was all set. It was all done. Of course, with the more trippy interstellar travel wormhole things, that's visual effects, but it's rear view projection, new modern LED light projection, miniatures he used, which he also used quite a lot for the Dark Knight trilogy. But all these things, the accumulation of the old way of making movies with the new modern way of movies, this has always been Nolan's habit. So why are you highlighting this specific film as being the be-all end-all of it? It's a sum of all the parts he's done before, but then again, you can't really appreciate it. The film is inconsistent, it is all over the place. It makes sense, narratively, where it went. I'd had no confusion, all apart from why was there... There's hardly any information where it matters about this device that enables you to go back in time. It's also a movie that's ashamed of admitting it's a time travel movie. And then there's these armies and this execution. And because of the rapidity and the fast-paced nature of it, you go from one scene to another, to another, to another, to another. So you kind of left going, so why are these different colour-banded armies battling against this big... infrastructure that's hiding the almost the center of this whole story? There's no background towards the device or how it's a there's no background detail as to how or why. I can't get my words together. It's I understood the story, the narrative, those beats with Pattinson's character later in the sequences about how he evolves, how these different things also. The action sequences where you're fighting person in reverse and the ultimate reveal in that in the movie of what it is. But in a sense, that cuts in and contradicts everything that's been told to you. There's not enough background. And maybe there is that mystique, but you need some information to go off to
And you need have to a see some consequences.
Mystique, a mystery.
But you need to see some consequences. You need to, not the main characters necessarily, but you need to see the people that... Like, the surrounding people that, you know, they need to see themselves back in time, you know, again, they need to look at themselves, and then there needs to be consequences so that you fear for the main characters. So you go, oh, my God, they're fighting each other, don't recognise each other, oh, my God, you know, so for that tension. But there's no stakes, really. And I got really confused
only
at the
for
end.
Michael Caine with his chips.
That's true. I got really confused at the end because... So many of them were going back so many times that it was a little bit unclear as to who was doing what, where, and why.
The nature of the movie is inversion, but the whole movie is an inversion of itself because it contradicts itself continuously. Mm. Also, there's not enough information about the MacGuffin, this device, this grand big device that is going to bring the end of the world. Tied to the most hammiest but the most compelling performance of the movie to a Russian oligarch played by Kenneth Branagh, who does such an extreme variation on a Russian accent, I think people who are actually Russian will leave the country embarrassed that he's done a performance that is such a OTT pantomimed, you know, stereotype of them, that they're like, we're ashamed of being Russian because this is how all people view Russians.
I know it's terrible, but I actually kind of liked his character more than
anyone else. I thought his character was the most compelling. He was unpredictable. The hammy performance and that nature, he was horrible.
He was
vicious.
The only one that gave me any emotion.
Yeah, he was vicious. He was spiteful.
Yeah.
And when it turns out his aim and goal, you go, oh, okay, I understand your character even more. You are that narcissistic and controlling. Mm. But I still don't understand... The central fugal system that if this Russian dies, the world ends. No explanation.
Yeah, but there's no,
It just is.
But then
that's
he dies.
Not mystery, is it?
No, but then he dies and the world doesn't end.
Exactly.
And there's no explanation as to, one, why would the world end if he died? And two, why is it that when he did die, the world didn't end?
Well, the thing is that there was a whole scape of timing and about her doing it right, that not doing it right. Okay, whatever. This film is full of misdirection, but not misdirection to twist and warp the narrative.
Yeah,
and the
for
things.
You to go later on and go, oh.
No, it doesn't do it.
No.
It inverts it because it wants to distract you from its inherent flaws. Yeah. Instead of actually focusing and honing in and trying to make head or tail of it. And, you know, anyone who goes against this picks faults of it like we are. They're going, you didn't understand it. Yeah, we understood it. There are certain moments where you're just scratching your head going, yeah. And guess what? I don't give a fuck. The different factions, the blue banded army, the red band, red arm banded army. Why? Who are they fighting against as well? We didn't see opposition. Also, where does this device come from? There's a MacGuffin. Yes, the MacGuffin is a system to move the plot. But to add to that mystery, you need some seedling of an idea of it, mm-hmm. from where it comes from, the history. Not just people going, oh, don't pay attention to it, this is just the way things are. No, it fucking isn't. We need some form of, it's not even called a compelling argument, we need something to compel us. You need a modicum of history behind something before there's mystery. Mystery, mythology, it does kind of come hand in hand, you know, the mythology of these devices. So the movie just leaves you scratching your head going, what was the point? I got nothing from this. I wasn't entertained for me personally. I didn't think it did anything. And everyone's coming out going, it's the best action movie ever. It really isn't. And other people going, it's Nolan's like tour de force. It isn't. And then there's others who actually tear it a new arsehole because it's kind of deserving of it. And it looked like this movie was not going to make any money. Well, that's been proven wrong because it just made $53 million and it hasn't even opened in the domestic market, that of America, yet. But $53 million, I think Nolan, you know, is going to get his money back. Also, Nolan has put half of the budget up for this, so we now know why he was so adamant for it to be released. As of when, because he's getting a 20% cut of the overall first day box office profits. That's what I like about Nolan. He puts his money where his mouth is, but he's now come to this position where he's like, I'm really unsure if people are going to see this, so I need to ensure this is a success so I get back half the money from signed copy that I've put into this.
You know, the only reason why people actually like it is purely because, one, it's Christopher Nolan, and I'm a Christopher Nolan fan, and two, because it's one of the first proper blockbuster films that's come out into the cinema.
Yeah, that
since
we have seen.
February.
Yeah. Also, I forgot to mention a certain movie in the introduction that we'll be reviewing. I've just realised, and this proves as the review what we're going to go on to, how unforgettable it is, The New Mutants. We are going to be reviewing The New Mutants after this segment ends. So, we end it on one star. Like you said, people are going to see it because it's Nolan. They're going to see it because it's the next big Hollywood blockbuster that we've had on screens for about 6 months. The last big Hollywood blockbuster was Bad Boys for Life, which we didn't see. Mm-hmm. But in all honesty, this movie is going to be a success no matter what, and people are going to find so much to love in it. And I can understand where you're coming from. I can see we're not telling you that you shouldn't like this or you're an idiot to like it. Though secretly and deep down, we kind of think that. Truth is, people will go, you don't understand it, or they'll fall back on the genre that it's contained within. Sorry, I just had to pause that because noisy neighbours of a junkie and wide boy variety are being really noisy arseholes! Anyway, you're going to fall back and lean on that genre trope of it's science fiction, it's meant to be that way, to excuse people who actually do have an issue with it, who do see a validity in their criticism. And there is a validity in our criticisms. This is why we think it's bad. No, you just didn't get it. No, we got it. And there was nothing there to get, really, for us personally. But anyway, one star for Tenet from Articulate Warbling. You can take that to the bank or you can put that on your Blu-ray DVD covers as a quote. Now, The New Mutants.
2 stars.
It's 2 stars.
It's slightly better than Tenet.
2 stars.
Look, I don't like horror movies. This was meant to be your first Marvel horror movie. It's meant to be creepy. I kind of liked the trailer. Thought it looked really good. Thought it looked actually quite scary. One of those things where I genuinely thought I might be a bit kind of like, oh, not sure I like this. And then we sat down in the comfiest seats known to mankind. Don't get me wrong, because they were recliner seats in the cinema. But the issue I had here was the fact that I wasn't, I wasn't tense. There was no thriller edge. There was no horror edge. And unfortunately, which makes this whole situation even worse, it felt a bit like your average superhero movie. Now, Zach doesn't agree with my opinion about superhero movies because he likes some of them. But for me, I find superhero movies really boring, okay? We start off, we see this person as a young person, as a child. They start to begin to realise that they have these powers. They grow into a young adult, so a teenager, and they start actually using these powers. And it's actually kind of dangerous for them because they're a teenager and they get angry and emotional and puberty and all that shit. Then they get taught by somebody, you know, some wise guy, or they manage to teach themselves, whatever. And then guess what? Somebody tries to ruin the world. They save the world. There's a romantic bit at the end where they fall in love with their Lois Lane or another person. And then cue end credits. For me, that's how I feel about superhero movies. There is one other movie that is technically considered to be a superhero movie that I don't think is applicable to that opinion, and that is Birds of Prey. But for me, The New Mutants was exactly the same. Kid manages to not die in like a World War III event, an apocalyptic event almost, and then gets to hone in on their skills as a early / late teenager, and then they save the world. Although this time it wasn't saving the world, this it was just saving hospitals.
No, amongst themselves. It's more about saving themselves from themselves and helping each other. There's a formulaic blueprint nature to all superhero movies, and yes, it is fatigue-inducing. Yes, it is a CGI bombathon. There's certain things that are just inherently always going to be the same thing. That is with X-Men. It has the same formula and the same tropes, and it's not evolved from it, all apart from X-Men Days of Future Past, out of which is more of a time travel thriller movie than anything else. And yet Laura has to watch this because she had such a bad experience with X-Men First Class. Which, you know what, up and rewatching it, I don't blame you. That film is inherently fucking flawed. Now, New Mutants has gone through a long fucking history of not developmental hell, but more trying to get it released on the big screen hell. 20th Century Fox looked at it, had an issue, said we're postponing it. This was before the merger with Disney, postponed it some more. They were hoping that Dark Phoenix, with all of its raperies put onto it from Fox. Fox are known for not giving a fuck about continuity. They're notorious for not really giving a damn about fans. They're really notorious for being money grabbers. And they looked at The New Mutants, as it is. It's going to be the first horror X-Men. Well, they got cold feet, and they were hoping that the future or the end of X-Men would have been in the hands of Dark Phoenix. Now, Dark Phoenix was a travesty, an atrocity. And then they kind of were like, we're definitely not putting out The New Mutants, of which, at this point, I understand why they didn't. But I realised eventually that this movie was finished. It was on a shelf. It wasn't like it needed reshoots, this, that. And there was rumour upon rumour. Rumours fizzled out. The merger happened and Disney looked at this. And apparently they said to Josh Boone, of whom's basically been sitting back going, what the fuck are you doing with my film? They went, we believe in this vision. And we also think that it should be released. They planned for an April release date. Then in the wake of COVID, they postponed it. Now finally, after 2 years of waiting to see what this great, notarized, messy, awful, not worthy of being put on the big screen movie is, I understand why they got cold feet. Release this up alongside Dark Phoenix and you would have basically gone, The New Mutants is a better movie, but, you know, it's the best of two evils. I'm happy that Josh Boone got to keep his theatrical cut, that there was no intrusion. There's rumours gathered now that there's a lot of people, as of now, reviewing, going, oh, there's loads of cuts, re-edits, but it's not much of a Frankenstein monster. Actually, no cuts or edits were made apart from the new 20th Century Studio logo, a few adjustments, and I think the visual effects of the title credits. But Josh Boone got to finish and editorialise it as he envisioned it. Maybe his editorial traits or additions or change-ups in the Disney merger may have been different from what he decided inevitably in its roll-up. But the thing is, this film was a finished piece, put on the shelf, and it was postponed. delayed. The release was delayed, but contractually, Josh Boone has come out. He's saying, before any form of digital or streaming release, this movie had to be released theatrically, no matter what. So no matter how long he may have sat down and wait for it to be released, I'm quite happy that Disney went, you know what, we see something in this. And I can understand, they look at this and go, the New Mutants, it's energised, it's got themes and, you know, story threads that are interesting, LGBTQ stuff. A very natural love story. I felt like the story, I think Laura disagrees on this, because she went, oh yeah, that was so cliched. I actually liked it. I thought it was like...
I didn't say I didn't like it.
No, but you said, oh, it was so... When we came out, you went, oh, it's so cliched, as so if you expected it. Well, yeah. But I thought it was a nice, natural thing. And Maisie Williams' character, alongside that other actress, I don't know her name.
Anya.
No, that's not Anya Taylor-Joy. She's not the one that she's in the relationship in it.
Oh, no, she's not. Sorry. My apologies. Blue Hunt.
Blue Hunt. Her relationship with Blue Hunt is natural. It's lovely. I think that is the most interesting, compelling thing for me. I understand the allegory and the symbology of angst and not feeling comfortable in your body. The whole emblem of mutants and X-Men is an allegory for sexuality, for diversity, ethnicity, different cultures, feeling alienated, disenfranchised, dislocated from reality, the outsiders. I like that this was a very small, contained movie. I like the sense of the characters and their engagement. I do like this film in that sense. When it comes to thrills, when it comes to chills, when it comes to being that X-Men horror movie, nothing. It flatlines.
It's made 9.9 million from the 67 million budget.
So far, but it's only been released in the UK and foreign markets so far. So they will be considering that a success at this point.
Yeah, probably.
Because it hasn't hit domestic, and domestic is where it makes money.
But again...
And China.
It's making money because that's all that anyone's seeing at the moment. There's nothing else to see. Unless you
and
want
Disney
to go...
have been smart with this marketing thing.
Unless you want to go and see your indie films, which we have, because that's the sort of thing we watch. Unless you're going to go and see that.
And we've been given that opportunity.
Which your mainstream viewers will not go and see those films. It means that these films will get their budget back because they're the only films. Tenet and The New Mutants are the only blockbuster
and
films.
And I think
out.
The pandemic has done something for The New Mutants. It has, because when the pandemic came, all the bigger movies were basically their release dates were cancelled out. They went to the drawing board and basically postponed for a good year or a year and a half. Or later in the year. With this one, everyone's like, oh my god, this poor fucking film. It's been delayed again and again. But now the market is empty of these big Hollywood type movies. Though this is a smaller X-Men movie on a lower budget, it's still a big Hollywood movie. It is still a franchise based film. It is still part of a big property.
Marvel.
Well, it's now merged with Disney, so it is a Marvel film. We all notice that it's in association with Marvel, whereas if this was released 2 years ago, it wouldn't even have that streak to look along the top.
The thing is the fact that it
it's the only thing that's there that they're like, oh, okay, what are we going to put out? What are we going to put out? We've still got The New Mutants. So they've used this to their advantage. They've gone,
it's
you know what,
clever,
instead of postponing this anymore... As we haven't got anything else to line up, this is a movie that's been sitting on the shelves. People are interested. Also, the market is empty of anything original or new at this moment because of the pandemic. Let's just throw this out, you know, just sporadically, just out of the blue. Let's just throw it there because it was only officially released that it was only officially announced a couple of weeks ago that it was going to get this release date, wasn't it? With the new posters and the new TV spots and the new trailers.
It's actually very difficult to book on cinema.
Mm.
Because... when you look at the films that are currently out, it's not there.
No, it's still the coming soon.
You have to go on the coming soon, find the cinema you want to watch it in, and then book it. Yeah. It's very difficult to book. The thing I don't like about the way that it's... feels like it's... feel like I've been tricked. I've been tricked to see it because that's all that I can see at the moment.
Yeah, and they've used that to their advantage.
But I don't like that because I find that really manipulative.
I think, well, most of the marketing and all that such and sundry in that industry and that media and that culture, that's the way the game is. I think it's interesting that they finally, instead of getting cold feet again, this jarring pandemic going, oh my God, people won't go out to see this at all, oh my God, because of what's going on. Instead, they've gone, you know what, we ain't got anything else lined up, nothing that big. We've got this little movie that's been sitting on the shelf for a while. We were going to release it at some point in this year. Contractually, we have to release it at some point. Let's just fucking do it. Let's go on a whim. Let's just throw it on the fucking screen and see how it goes. And how it's going is, it's being ripped apart because it's boring. It's boring. There's no jumps, there's no thrills, there's no chills. I like the allegory, I like the characters' engagements. Anna Taylor-Joy is just a delight to watch, playing a nasty, nasty Russian assassin, alternate dimension. No, you do at the end, because you saw the layers.
Yeah.
And the only actual thing that has any horror or creepy element is her fear. Now, this whole movie is about a young woman whose power it is, naturally, to bring people's fears to life and to basically scare you to death, or those fears become embodied and real and kill you. I think it's a nice concept. A nice concept. It's true and respectful towards its source material, but it's just relatively bland. I mean, if this was released alongside Dark Phoenix as intended, or as of when it was meant to, they would have said, yeah, it's better than Dark Phoenix, but it's still got the inherent same flaws. It's messy, and it's not messy because people have editorialised it and butchered it like Dark Phoenix. It's just not a very well-made movie in the sense that, editorially, it's boring. You're thrown in the deep end really quickly, and you don't get to know these characters until it's much later in the film and their fears become apparent to them, and then within 25 minutes the film ends. I like that it tried to tie it up with Logan, but there's a great continuity error there. If you're trying to tie it up with Logan and the Essex Corporation and that world, in Logan, when those children are being captured for the Essex Corporations and trained to be killers, this is a world where X-Men don't exist. So if you're trying to tie it up with that world, be respectful to the narrative that's been told in Logan. The X-Men don't exist. Charles Xavier is known to be dead. So these young kids going, oh, they're training us up to be X-Men. They're training us up to be tutored by the old, you know, think machine. Well, no, those kids in this reality, in this side pocket of that universe and that continuity of that world, if you're trying to tie yourself to Logan, respect the story. Don't go, we're tying it to that film because it will make people go, ah, which it did me. I mean, it dawned on me. Well, obviously, you're tying it to a movie, but not, again, sticking to continuity at all. If you're going to do something with good intention, be respectful and realise what's going on. In that world, Professor X doesn't exist anymore. The X-Men are dead. So these kids getting excited about potentially going to the X-Mansion is void. So its tie and its respect and its continuity and connection with Logan is void. Because it doesn't fucking... it doesn't tally up. And again, it is known that 20th Century Fox did not give a fuck about continuity with the X-Men films. Now, We've been relatively positive about the characters and the engagements. So what is the overall issue, do you think, Laura, that we had with it?
It was boring.
It was boring.
It just had nothing to it. There was no... I don't like horror movies, but I don't go and watch a horror movie because I want to be sitting there bored, tapping my fingers, waiting for it to end. I watch a horror movie knowing that it's an hour and a half and thinking, my fucking God, that felt like 10 minutes, but also felt like 3 and a million
yeah,
years.
Yeah, it was a 94-minute movie that felt like it was a 144-minute movie.
But the thing is with some horror movies, it does feel like that. Well, I do, because I get scared and I don't like them. So I do get a bit like, oh my God, when's this going to end? Because I don't think I can hack it anymore. But there's a difference between when is this end because I can't hack it anymore because I'm so tense and I'm so anxious and I'm like scratching at my neck and I get all like red hot rashes where it's like heat rash and I get really panicky and my heart's constantly beating. And then there's this where it feels like I've been sat here for a million years and I'm thinking about the drive home and what we're going to have for dinner tonight.
Yeah.
There's the difference. When I'm watching a horror movie, which we'll go on to
It's that build-up, that tautness.
Yeah, but
that makes a horror movie successful.
But like later we'll talk about Paranormal Activity 3. That film is something where you're literally sat there and you're like paralysed in your own fear. There's that, and then there's just like paralysed by boredom.
Because there's no lead-up, there's no... A lot of people have an inherent criticism for horror movies and jump scares. It's part of the formula. There's not even one jump scare in this film. Not one. And there's no execution of jumps. And maybe the horror...
I thought the bear was really cute. It weren't meant to be.
Maybe the horror comes from their conflict and angst, yes, but you don't lean into that on a performance level or even a cinematic level enough for it to pay off and have that adage added to it or that opinion or that, you know, that high acclaim. It's not about the horror of the execution of the film cinematically. It's the horrors that these kids are going through. Well, if it's not compelling enough on a cinematic level or a story level for us and it's not conveyed in that sense. Also, what annoys me is marketing the film with those faces coming out the walls, out of the white walls as a tribute and ode to, of course, Nightmare on Elm Street. That's the full emblem of the marketing and the big crux of the trailers of all these weird ethereal creatures pushing through the walls as if it's a textured gauze or through neck curtains. Not in the movie. I don't like that. We had an issue like that with The Invisible Man. The whole marketing was about the hand. But luckily enough and funnily enough, Lee Whannell, who directed The Invisible Man, made mention of this in his hilarious and very entertaining audio commentary, which me and Laura would recommend you listen to. And it was Laura's cherry popping on audio commentary listening. So anyway, New Mutants, what is there? It is what it is. I think this big, there's this exacerbated excitement of, what is so bad about this film? Or what is it about this film that made it not deserve? And what is it about this film that now all of a sudden Disney have such faith in it to put it on the screen? I just think it's a lot of coincidence, it's a lot of circumstances ascribed to it with different people in power, with different positionings and different opinions, and that's just got to a point.
To make your money back on a film that was just going to sit on the shelf ordinarily.
Yeah, that was initially its fate. Yeah, New Mutants, 2 stars. Maisie Williams is amazing in it. I really liked her in this. It was good to see her outside of the norm, which is Game of Thrones, out of which I gave up with because I thought the books were bland, and Game of Thrones isn't as big as it should be. And there has been a meme recently. It's like fans of Lord of the Rings, 10 years later, still has a huge fan base and people love it and will rewatch it. Harry Potter, 10 years later, there are still millions of fans and new fans coming to it and rewatching it. Game of Thrones ended last year. Hasn't got millions of people. No one wants to rewatch it. And that is the... I think the thing that... What compels you initially in your overall critique of a film is, would you want to watch it again? I always think that is it rewatchable? And New Mutants isn't. No. I don't really want to watch it again. I would be interested in audio commentary from Josh Boone for him to, you know, dig up the dirt, throw out the gossip and know his intentions behind it. But the intentions are pretty obvious. He thought he was doing a well-intended movie. He was excited for it. And he felt, you know, rightly wronged by the studio at the time. But I can understand the studio's angst by Dark Phoenix and then looking at New Mutants and going, this ain't yet any better. I don't have faith in it. So I understand from looking at it why they didn't put it out there. I'm happy that they did. So now, instead of an executive telling us what is good for us, you know what I mean, we can judge for ourselves. But I think with the rumour mill and the huge... And I think the negative press has been a benefit to it. I think more interest is generated towards this because of its delay and its history and its lead up to release than anything else.
I think everybody's trying to prove a point.
Yeah. Yeah. So, New Mutants, 2 stars. It's got some nice visuals, it's got some nice creature designs, but what it's sold and pitched to you as, it really ain't. Also, there's continuity errors in this one as well. Bloody nose, no bloody nose. Leaking nose, no leaking nose. Scab, dried blood nose, then no blood scab nose at all. Yeah. Laura's... This episode is going to be yawn, yawn, yawn from Laura's end. Because Laura was really struggling to want to do these podcasts because the first few films are bad. And when you don't have much to say about them, you're bored. And inherently bored. So let's go on to something that we may be infused about.
Let's talk about Time.
About Time.
Now, this is a film that I had seen in the cinema. Zach had attempted to watch on Channel 5 with painful adverts in between and probably a little news flash at 10:30. So...
It was actually film 4, ladies and gents. And, yeah, too many adverts.
It's a rom-com. I don't like rom-coms. I don't like rom-coms because I don't... It just all feels a bit fake. It all feels a bit fantasy fairy tale. I usually find that the comedy's pretty shite, but this is one on my list of quite a few rom-coms that I actually enjoy.
Yeah, you do like rom-coms, it's just the majority of them are, again...
I don't like the idea of them.
Genre-tropic, they're very much the be-all, end-all of what they are. Clichéd, predictable.
Yeah, they are. They're clichéd, they're predictable, and there's always a happy ending.
But when you infuse it with a different genre or a different element like this one, time travel, it adds layers and it adds something for you to play with even more.
Yeah, and you're kind of willing him not to travel in time in some of the areas, and then other times you're like, quick, get back to that cupboard and change what you said.
Yeah.
Whatever, but...
Richard Curtis's most funny, most clever, most emotional, most superb film. Rating, remember? Your rating. For All About Time.
No, Just About Time.
I thought it was All About Time.
Just About Time.
About Time.
5 stars.
5 stars myself. Domhnall Gleeson, superb. A real compelling, lovely, awkward performance from him. But
neither of us can stand Rachel McAdams, but this film, she...
You fall in love with her with him. You want them to work. And I love all the different gags and the vignettes and, you know, I like the consistency of his character and the way he will re-repeat almost... not a live, die, repeat situation, but repeat certain things until he perfects it and betters it. Also, the central relationship between Rachel McAdams, of course, is pivotal, but there's another one in this film that just got to me, and it's his relationship with his dad, who bestows upon him in his real Bill Nighy way, man, that is kind of groovy.
Yeah, but I also kind of like his relationship with his sister.
Oh, yeah, that as well.
It's really lovely.
The film is so well fleshed out. It's great performances and great writing, and it's good story. And they use those genre types. If you said that Richard Curtis is doing a science fiction romantic comedy, you would go, eh? What? And Laura said to me, this ain't a time travel movie that you would expect or you would like. But no, I knew that I would love it because they're taking something that is not... You know, romantic comedies, you don't go hand in hand with science fiction or those elements. But when you translate that and you kind of have a mixed bag of it, and when you almost invert those tropes and those expectations and you just genre blend, it can be a beautiful thing. And Richard Curtis did something beautiful. He told a really compelling, deep story, not just about family, but about consequences, and also about the right decision and when not to want to change it. And also, this guy is in the capability of changing it. And it's also an allegory where we sit back and go, oh, I wish I could go back and change that. This character has that power to do that. But it also shows that it will have a ripple, cause and effect down the line. At one point, it changes the sex of his child.
Yeah.
And I'm watching About Time, the clever stuff of with the time travel elements, and the density of it, and the meaning, and the allegory, and also the themes, and also the inherent moral attitudes and platitudes that are conveyed to you. You would expect that from Christopher Nolan's Tenet, but you don't. Instead, you get it from a romantic comedy from Richard Curtis.
And it threw you as well, didn't it?
You don't expect the unexpected. Yeah. It's unpredictable. Because that element of knowing what you eventually... We eventually glean that if you decide to do one thing, and that it comes quite early in the film where he decides to help his playwright friend in a successful...
performance play.
Yeah. What? Help me. I'm struggling. It's basically he has a playwright friend and he's got a hit play on his hands, but one of the actors fucked up, and the main character Domhnall Gleeson plays decides to, instead of going on this dating in the dark blind date, quite literally, he goes to support him, and he kind of gives one of the actors a shove and goes, I think you need to remember your lines, because this is like, you know, with all plays that are released for the first time, it's that generating that uproar, that the plaudit, like the first new play, you know, its first performance, and this actor apparently just
flatlined on it and he goes to the wrong person. And then he soon realises this. And then again, he uses that time thing to his element, but in a really clever way where he ends up going backstage and holds up placards where the lines are. And Richard E. Grant's character was actually the one struggling instead of the big fat actor who plays Harry Potter's uncle. It's just really clever, but then you realise that this vetoes that of which you have already experienced. You have not gone on that date, you have not received. So it's not a case of you can be in multiple places in that one timeline. You can go back in time and you can only be in that place once. And he soon realises this because he realises he doesn't have Mary's number on his phone. He goes back, Mary's not there. That realisation of shit, but he clues into those little elements that he garnered from previous experiences and then applies them to when he basically stalks her at a Kate Moss gallery, and then thus realising that all the information gathered from previous experiences, the initial experience, he applies to try and swell her, try and get in her knickers, basically.
It doesn't work, does it?
No.
She's got a boyfriend, and it's like, well, hang on a minute, when did you find this guy?
Then he needs to know those specific dates. Because
but it's the way he does it, in the sense that he's like, oh, I have a really vivid imagination. Like, I find it really difficult to imagine something unless I know, like, exactly where it is and what time it is. And it's very clever, because as an audience, we're laughing. But as being in that situation, and people are like, okay, and then end up giving out their address and shit like that. And it's
just... and the thing is, it's the desperation, because he has to, because he knows that he can't go back and go on that blind date thing, because then that will then veto his landlord and his friend's play. And then that's why he's picking, like, striving to go to that time way before he actually initially met her, so then he could corner her, to then ensure that she doesn't pell up with an absolute dick. And there's that funny moment where they pass this guy who he ends up basically cancelling out that guy's future with Mary. And he's like, what a dick!
And then she's like, yeah, he is actually quite a bit of a dick.
So he saved her from that in the overall timelines. And the thing what I love, it's not about multiple timelines and multiple dimensions. It's just about that one timeline and that. On those days you go, it will change someone else's course of their life. But it's not the reality of, well, if you do this with her in another reality, it will be a thing. None of that is there. It's a very plaintive, one long stretch, one linear timeline that he just goes back and he messes with to benefit him for his overall future. They can't travel in the future, but in the past. And there, it says a lot about that. It's that, sorry, that a cliched line, with great power comes great responsibility. It is, and he comes to realise this when his sister is basically become an alcoholic, and she's very...
She crashes her car.
She's a bit of an alcoholic, she's depressed, and she's a bit implosive, self-destructive mode. And he goes and he changes a timeline to befit her, but it doesn't befit him because it changes his sex. And that's when more information...
Not his sex, his baby sex.
His baby sex. And then you glean more information from Bill Nighy, who's like, look, man, once a baby's born, and it just gives you a little bit more. It is actually relatively easy to follow. At one point, I got a little bit confused and had to turn to Laura and go, please, can you just map this out for me a little bit? But it's very clever. It uses... It just takes advantage of those science fiction elements and just masterfully conveys so much in a 124-minute... And I will actually go out to say a masterpiece. This is like one of my favourite films now. It's so fucking beautifully made, performed. There's so much there behind it. It's clever. It is just ingenious. It's sweet. It's lovely. It's life-affirming in a lot of ways. And yeah... About time. 5 stars.
So, I wrote them down because I'm rubbish at remembering shit. A Truth or Dare on Fantasy Island.
A Jeff Wadlow double bill.
I think we should start with Fantasy Island, as that was the first we watched.
That was the first one we watched.
Something that we saw advertised at cinema some time ago now, and then found for a lovely cheap price in HMV whilst on a little day trip out. Something that I was initially a little bit worried about, to be honest, because, you know, it's
marketed as a horror movie, blah, blah, blah.
Is Blumhouse.
It is Blumhouse, but it was very good. Surprisingly very good.
Yeah.
And I very much like Lucy Hale. Lucy Hale plays Aria in Pretty Little Liars. I really enjoy her performance overall. I think she's a very good actress. And was actually surprised to see her in something like this because I hadn't seen her in much, if anything else, other than Pretty Little Liars, which was like 8 seasons worth of tense yumminess. But then she turns out to be the bad guy.
Spoiler alert, ladies and gents.
Well, come on, you don't listen to Articulate Warbling without expecting some form of spoilers.
We would hope that you've seen the film by this point.
But yeah, I just think it was brilliantly made, and the story was very, very good. Very interesting. And something that... It's funny, because when you watch horror movies, you're kind of scared because you feel like... I don't know, it's one of those things, it's like you can kind of convince yourself like, that had never happened, that had never happened. But somehow, with this film and with Truth or Dare, which we'll come on to, they're the two films that actually kind of made me feel a bit unnerved.
Yeah, both these films, in a lot of ways, do something with time and cause and effect. And
it's less scary, more unnerving, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, it's all taunt and it's taut and it's tension. There's a lot of horror films put out there now, and, you know, horror... There's a full spectrum of what horror is, and I think there is a thriller element so inherent in it, and though there's a lot of people like Nick Garris who go, you are not calling it horror... when it should be called horror, you're calling it thriller. Look, there's a whole spectrum of horror, and there is an inherent thriller manner. And, way. So, it is a horror, but it's thriller elements. It is a thriller in of itself, and it is. It's a chiller. It's built up of, it's tension. I like it because we've come away from Tenet and we're kind of disheartened that it wasn't as, you know, compelling as it should have been. And when we come across a movie like Fantasy Island where you expect the least of it because it's of that certain brand, it's Blumhouse, it's low budget, and then it turns out to be really bombastic, interesting and multifaceted and layered and offers you more than you anticipated. So Fantasy Island for me got 4 stars. Jeff Wadlow is an interesting director. He's mostly known for being a script man, and I think he's a director basically who's on lease with Universal. I think the last film he did before Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island was Kick-Ass 2, which was a really good, actually, sequel. I really liked it, and I really like Jeff Wadlow because he obviously likes this genre. He also really likes his lead actress.
He does. He's obviously got a bit of a thing for Lucy Hale.
And her stomach, and her moles on her stomach.
I think that's her, not him. I think it might be a her thing. She did a lot of it in Pretty Little Liars.
What, showing her?
Yeah.
Her tummy.
A lot.
It's so probably a contractual thing where Lucy Hale must show her toned body. But Jeff Wadlow's an interesting director in the South that now he's obviously a director for hire via Universal. He's a script man. He's been involved with a lot of productions that just haven't come about, like the He-Man films, the X-Force film. But it's nice to see that through his relationship with Universal, he's created a bond with Blumhouse, and he's got, obviously, a real good relationship with Jason Blum and the Blumhouse creatives, where they believe in his vision and his stories. Because Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island are pretty much, you can tell, they're from the same director. I know that Fantasy Island is more of a B-movie, Rorschach type movie. It's kind of, you know, it's aware of what it is, whereas Truth or Dare, what I liked about Truth or Dare is it's very sincere in what it's doing. But Fantasy Island is interesting. It offers a lot. It's entertaining. It's not going to win awards, but my overall point is it's good to see that Jeff Wadlow, after so long being involved with so many projects that just didn't take off, that he's found a home with Blumhouse where they believe in his vision, they give him the budget, and it makes a lot of money. And they have that mutual understanding. You make what you want to make. I give you the budget, and I like that creative freedom that Blumhouse gives directors like Jordan Peele and Jeff Wadlow. And I think Jeff Wadlow Wiedlow should be recognised for the talent that he is. He makes really fast-paced, interesting movies. And when they're not as fast-paced as expected, like Truth or Dare, there's so much there. He's a good writer. He's a genre filmmaker, a genre lover. And he is a singular vision. Like, though there's a lot of things behind director for hire or directors who are leased out from other studios. My meaning of that is he was just sitting at Universal's being wasted. He wasn't doing anything. He was going from one project to another, couldn't get it up off its feet. And then he's come, because he's known for doing horror and he's come from that background of making that. And then coming up against Blumhouse and Jason Blum being the master and genius producer and creative head that he is, to find that unilarity and that union with him. He goes, I like your stories, I like your films, I like what you have to offer, here's the money, go fucking make it, go crazy. And I like that freedom that Blumhouse gives their creators, that filmmakers like Jeff Wadlow, who are extremely talented, don't go to waste. And it is obvious that he has a lot of good stories to tell. So Fantasy Island gets 4 stars from me.
4 stars from me.
And now Truth or Dare. Now that is Jeff Wadlow's return to the big screen. His 2018 first Blumhouse horror. And I didn't anticipate it to be the supernatural monster that it is. I thought it was going to be that type of like Scream factor where someone's behind this making people do Truth or Dare. And there's like this whole system behind them, like an organisation. Quite similar to Escape Room. But actually Truth or Dare is probably one of the most surprising, most interesting recent horror films I have seen. It plays its genre tropes up to a T, but it's taunt, it is fast, it is visually beautiful, it's clever, it's got great characters, horrible characters. It's just compelling, and for me personally, it's a 5-star film. It is so fucking interesting. The whole setup, the prism of it all.
It's very creepy. Like, I actually had bad dreams about it last night. Because it is. It's not scary faces. It's not your traditional, like, I mean, there was a dead person in it, but, you know, it's not your...
And there are scary faces.
Yeah, but not scary as in, like, a dead witch or devils and shit like that. And it does creep into the kind of possession supernatural thing, but it's very cleverly done and actually freaked me out more than most other horror movies because it... That's what I mean. It's more unnerving.
Unpredictability films, factor as well.
But these films are more unnerving than they are scary. It's unnerving and it's more freaky than most other horror movies because it's scary. It's not your traditional jump scares. There was a couple of times that I was a bit sort of jumpy. But it honestly freaked me out far more than any other horror movie I think has.
Yeah, and I believe, like, as I was saying about the thriller elements and horror and all that, like, there is a distinguishability between a thriller like Heat and, like, the type of, like, you know, like, action films. There's thriller action, but there's also thriller horror. And those are the type of things that I think really appeal to Laura. So Laura may go out of her way and go, I really don't like horror movies, but I think she does. But that side of things, horror, thriller, because they are those thriller elements. It's about tension. It's about anxiety. It's about sweating so much that you feel like you're wearing a full nappy / diaper. It's a seat of your pants type frills and spills, and it is. And then it's not about the initial jump scare. It's an initial jump of what's going to happen next, the unpredictability factor and the ratcheting up of it when it initially happens with the characters' engagements. Who's going to accept the dare? What is the dare going to be? What is the consequence going to be of this person who doesn't do this dare?
I think what I like about this film most is the fact that it is, for me, it's a mix between Saw, even though it's not supernatural. You've got Saw, which is very much somebody tells you, whoever it is, somebody tells you what you have to do in order to survive. And there's a Final Destination thing about it too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So you know, it follows you no matter what. It will.
It always follows you, but also that fact
you can't get out of it.
But it's the fact that the... You know, the point is that you can't not do the dare, you can't not tell the truth, and you can't refuse to play the game because you will die.
Yeah.
And the way in which the people die are the ways... They are very Final Destination-y.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When you look at them, it's just like somebody's going to fall on a pool cue and it's going to go through them. Somebody's going to fall on a metal gate that's got, you know, pointy bits. that you're going to, like, you know...
Spikes, yeah.
Spikes that are going to, like, go through your body.
Impale,
like,
you, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very much like...
And it's, it is, because you're looking out for household common objects, and how are these people going to be picked off by them?
The only thing I didn't like about this film was the fact that I felt like using guns was just a bit... I don't know, it felt like it was a bit too easy to kill someone with a gun. Like, and I think that's my thing, because I like things like Final Destination and Saw, because it's less, less kill yourself with a gun and shoot yourself in the head, more find really complicated ways of killing yourself.
From, like, household, like, gadgets, yeah, exactly. And, like traps,
you know,
and...
Spoiler alert, there's this one guy, he goes to impale himself on a pool cue, somebody moves a pool cue, so instead, he rolls his foot on a pool ball instead and breaks his neck on the other pool table. You know, it's that is more Final Destination for me. And then when they start using things like guns, I'm like, oh, that's kind of boring.
The thing is, not many people are actually killed initially by guns. There's only one person, really, who was killed by a gun.
Two.
Well, one, because it wasn't actually anyone involved in the truth or dare thing. It was just a copper shooting him in the back.
Three, then. The guy that got shot in the back, the girl who saved Lucy Hale's character,
and then she shot herself. The head,
so yeah. Three people died from using guns, and that's where I think it just feels like a bit of a cop-out. Like, using a gun, it's just like, oh, no, that's kind of boring. Like, I want it to be more interesting.
Yeah,
I managed to kill you with, like, something really random.
Like the guy who stabbed himself in the eye with a pen.
Yeah, exactly. And then headbutted it further into his brain. That, for me, is much more... interesting and disgusting and Final Destination-y than just using a gun. That just felt like a bit of a, like, it's kind of boring.
Yeah, but I did like the multi-faceted nature of telling truths and being true to not just the game but to your friends, and how it opens up cracks in relationships.
And I think you know, Olivia, which is, again, Lucy Hale's character, she doesn't want to, you know, she doesn't pick truth because she doesn't want to tell the worst truth of her life. And then she picks Dare, and it's, I dare you to tell the other girl, the Simaki, this secret that you don't want to tell. So even when she picks Dare, she still ends up having to tell the truth.
And that is a lot of Lucy's... the pain is less physical with Lucy, apart from her having to break her hand.
And shoot herself in the arm, effectively, with Marky's.
But it's more psychological when it comes to Lucy. It's very psychological about the effects of, you know, telling the truth, how much how the truth can hurt you and hurt others, and how it will have ripple effects, and or how it may also cause the eventuality of something that is physical. It's very clever, and Jeff Wadlow is a clever writer. A lot of people wouldn't give him that because he's one of those writers for hires, and he does a lot of projects that don't get made. Well, that ain't the case anymore. He actually is a good writer. I don't know, a lot of people think this is sacrilegious, but I got more from watching Fantasy Island on a psychological dense level, and definitely this can be said and very true of Truth or Dare, from Truth or Dare, than what I got from Tenet. What you expect or anticipate from Tenet emotionally and viscerally and physically and, you know, cinematically and experientially, you get from these two films.
The thing is I can watch almost any movie, give or take. And it's not for me, you know, for Zach it's very much around, you know, loyalties with directors, with actors, with actresses. I mean, yes, I have loyalties to some actors and actresses, and maybe some directors, but for me, it's about the storytelling. And the thing is it doesn't matter for me who made what. It's about whether I actually felt something from it.
Mm.
Whether that be a romantic comedy and I felt, you know, I felt love and I laughed, and whether it be about, you know, horrors or thrillers where I'm tense and I'm sweaty and I'm sat on the edge of my seat. It's not about anything else for me, personally, than to actually physically enjoy what I'm supposed to enjoy in that movie.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I can see some people's like, oh, it's this person's film or it's that person's film. But I think there needs to be this kind of remembrance with a lot of people, not necessarily you, but other people, is that just because it's a certain person's film doesn't mean that it's going to be a good film. But then you find people that get all of this credit for being such an amazing director, make a shit film, but they still make really good money from it. And then you find somebody who shits on a director, but their films are really good.
Yeah.
And that frustrates me, because it's like, actually, you need to sometimes to take yourself away from that loyalty you have for certain directors or certain, you know, production companies, for example, just because it's Blumhouse doesn't mean it's going to be a really good film. I've watched 3 Blumhouse films recently that are really good.
I've watched a lot of Blumhouse films that are really shit.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
Does it change my relationship with them? I'm just going on about Jeff Wadlow because I feel he needs to be respected for what he's offered and
what
deserves.
I'm saying is the fact that people need to stop shitting on people just because they think that, because they made one, that's what I mean. If Christopher Nolan made one bad film, do you shit on him? No.
And his line of films before, yeah.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. Like, just sometimes I think people need to just take themselves away from that a little bit, because actually it doesn't necessarily... It's not all about a director.
No.
I think that's the thing. Yes, somebody directs a film, so they're overall kind of responsible for it, if you like. But, you do also need to have compelling actors and actresses that do good jobs
mm-hmm.
at what they're supposed to do and make things compelling. And this is what I find frustrating, not with you, but I mean with like other people. It's like, somebody made this film, it's going to be good. Same with Tenet.
Mm.
It must be good because it's a Christopher Nolan film, and I'm not going to see it any other way because it's a Christopher Nolan yeah. film. That frustrates me. Because it's not all about him.
No.
It's about the people that are acting in it.
Yeah.
It's about the storyline. And if he didn't write the story, it's not necessarily his fault entirely. Do you know what I mean?
Some
directors do write them. They write, they direct, they produce, they do this, they do that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they even have their own little part in it, a little bit part. You know? And it just sometimes frustrates me a little bit that it's just like, because it's a this person's film, it must be.
It has to be, and it will be.
Groundbreakingly amazing.
Yeah, revolutionary.
And that's what frustrates me sometimes, because it's just like, there's loyalty to an actor, to an actress, to a director, to a production company, or to a producer, fine. But you can't let that take over your overall opinion of a film.
No.
And that's the thing, it's just like, you know, I think that is the point that I come from, and how we manage to have the conversations that we do is because you can see from my point of view, but you have a lot of loyalty. I have pretty much nothing.
Mm.
And the fact is we can meet in the middle.
The thing is, I'm loyal to filmmakers who, if they, even if it's one film, I have a loyalty to them because they made me experience and enjoy that one film, and I'm interested in seeing what else they will do,
yeah.
potentially. Whereas a lot of people, like saying, they're blinkered. I like this one filmmaker and everything and anything he does. Like, it's a case
of... He's blinded.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, when somebody dies, you put them on a pedestal. They were amazing. They were this. Well, sometimes people aren't always good.
Yeah.
They're not always perfect. They have imperfections. And it frustrates me that people's loyalty blinds them from actually seeing whether a film is good or not.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, like I said, we can have the conversations that we can, because you have, not as bad as others, but you have a loyalty for certain people, certain directors, certain this, certain that. I have basically nothing. I enjoy some people. Like, there are some actors and actresses I really
There's
like.
Some directors that when their film comes out, you go, oh, I'm interested in seeing that.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be like, it's going to be amazing yeah, you've decided gonna, yeah. to begin with.
I'm not going
to
be blinded by it. And this is the thing. It's like, and people do the same. It's like, I love Harry Potter. Okay. So that means you must love every Harry Potter film. Incorrect. I don't. I don't love them all.
No.
I like most of them, but there are some that I know that aren't as good as others. It's the same with
The Crimes of Grindelwald.
But it's the same as, you know, Fast and Furious. Everyone's like, you like the Fast and Furious films. You will love the next one. I'd like to think I'll love it, and I'd be really disappointed if I don't. But that doesn't mean that because I like the first 9, that I'm going to like the 10th.
Mm.
It's not the case. That's not true at all, and that's what frustrates me, is the loyalty isn't always with a director or an actor or an actress, it's also about the storyline or a franchise.
Mm-hmm.
You like that franchise, so you must like every single one of those movies in that franchise and those that are coming up.
Yeah.
That's not the case, and it frustrates the hell out of me, because it's like, can you not just stop for a minute and put that in a box in your head? Yes, okay, you like this director, you like this actor or actress, but then you won't see the actual film, because you're just constantly, it's like beer goggles.
Yeah.
It is, isn't it? That girl's fit. I'm going to follow her around. You see her the next morning, you go, she's a 2, not a 10.
Mm.
It's a beer goggle situation.
Mm.
I really like Christopher Nolan, so I'm going to put on my Christopher Nolan beer goggles.
Mm-hmm.
Tenet's amazing.
Mm.
Take them off. Tenet's not that good.
Mm-hmm.
And it works the same for, I like thriller movies. That doesn't mean that every thriller is a good one.
No. Oh, we know that. From but, regression.
But that's what I mean. It's that same situation of, like, it does, just because you like a certain genre, you like a certain director, you like a certain actor or actress or whatever else, it doesn't mean that every film that they're in or they make or whatever else is going to be a good one.
Yeah.
And people need to come off of that high horse, I think.
Yeah.
Why don't you do your bit about... I'm really sorry, I keep forgetting his name.
Oh, Chadwick Boseman. Yeah, it was just very sad and a real great shock to so many, not just fans and obviously to people who've worked with him in the industry. This episode will be dedicated in his memory. He stood up for more than just being Black Panther and being one of the first modern black superheroes. He's going to be remembered for his strength, his passion, his dedication, his kindness, his professionalism, and also his outlook on life. This man had been fighting through chemotherapy surgeries, but kept it to himself. There's a great altruism to him. He was, from what we can glean from the information and the interviews and the archives and from everyone else's engagements, a rare soul who was, you know, taken off us far too soon. But he made use of those final years on this earth that he may have knew. We don't know the full crux of it, but he made the most of his time on this earth, and he contributed not just to cinema and to his legacy, but also to other people's lives, going to cancer wards, activism. He was a beautiful soul, and it's just a shame that he's went. It's a shame that he passed and it went this way, but I think he knew the bigger picture, the broader picture. To be honest, it has shook me up a lot, because we know that these types of movies, Marvel, you're signed up contractually for 13 or 10, and to think that he went through those motions of, you know, I'm going to sign up for these movies, whether or not I'm going to survive it. And I think he knew inherently that he was going to pass, but with that motion of thought and application of thought.
I think it's about positivity as well, isn't it? It's about having that positivity to say, oh, I'm going to sign up for X amount of films, because, you know, at the age that he was, you wouldn't expect to be dying or to, you know, to pass away. And I think it is that positivity thing of, if I sign up to these films, then I've
set myself a goal. And
yeah, all. It is.
That could have even been his, like, bucket list mentality as well.
Yeah, it may be. I mean, you can hypothesise all day and you probably, you know, you might get it right, you might not. It's difficult, but it's one of those things where, you know, I think he did right in what he did in creating a positive world for himself, creating something for him to look forward to. Because that's the thing, when you're in a position where you're, you know, terminally ill or have something that has the potential to kill you, I think you go through a stage where it's quite easy to fall into the negativity, fall into the, I'm ill and I don't want to get out of bed, you know. And it's with cancer and other terminal illnesses and other long, you know, lifelong issues that can cause death early. It's one of those things where you fall into a depression because you think, I can't be bothered. And actually, I personally think that he made the right choice to sign up for those films, because he wasn't giving up on himself. No. And his love and his passion was obviously acting. Yeah. So for him, I think it was easier for him to sign up to something, even if he couldn't, you know, go through with it, even if he wasn't able to manage all of those films. It's actually something that keeps him getting up out of bed every day, seeing his friends, seeing his on-set family, you know, and just like keeping his mind busy, because there's nothing worse than sitting at home wallowing.
Oh, exactly. And I think he did something beautifully in the sense that he kept it to himself. He did not, even those closest to home and closest of friends, he kept it close to his chest. Only those within his general vicinity, like his partner and his family, knew of this. And I think that there's a real great altruism to him, where he didn't want to be a victim. He didn't want people also to be savvy to this information, because he probably didn't want to be treated as such, because you are, no matter. If you come out and say, I'm terminally ill or I'm dying, the more people around you generate that weird, and it's not even,
it's pity.
Pity. He didn't need that. He didn't want that.
And I don't think anybody would.
No.
You know, when you turn around and you go, oh, I've got cancer. I've been diagnosed with cancer. Oh my God, you poor thing. And everybody treats you. Everybody treats you in a way that is full of sympathy, full of pity.
And it's actually kind of,
that brings you further into that depression, I think, because you're just like, oh, I can't do what I want to do, because people are constantly like, oh no, you shouldn't do that. Because, and it's actually, and this is
a really bad comparison because it's nothing like it, but it's similar to when you're pregnant.
Mm.
And people are like, oh, don't do that because you're pregnant. Don't do that because you've got cancer. That was his
fear. He wouldn't get film roles or be able to continue.
No, you've actually, yeah, it's almost discrimination. And actually, he's probably had enough of that in his life, given his background.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably had enough of discrimination. And quite frankly, he wants to do good. What does he want to do good by? His fans?
And his,
the fans and of the movies?
And he used his success and his rapid incline and success, whilst for his own trials and tribulations and the horrors be that your body is killing you, he still went to these wards. He still was that image. He lived up to that image of Black Panther, that he was a king of peace, prosperity, honour, vitality. And it's just...
But that's nicer than sitting wallowing in your own self-pity because...
For 4 years until you degenerate and look back and go, what have I done in those 4 years?
Exactly. And it is a bucket list type of situation, I think. And it's something that you just kind of sit there and you go, okay, so what can I do? I can wallow and maybe try and heal myself or make the most of everything that I can. And the thing is, his chances are, no matter which way he'd chosen, he probably still would have passed when he did.
Exactly.
I think that's the saddest thing. But I think the best thing about it, and there are no good things about death, but I think the best thing about it is he's made the most he possibly can of those last 4 years of his life.
And he did.
And he's done everything he possibly can.
For himself and others.
For himself, for his family, to show that actually he just carried on and that he is a kind of hero. And the fact that he is kind of almost living up to his character that he plays on a regular basis is that he's this good guy that does everything he can.
Full of laughter, light and hope.
Exactly, exactly. Exactly that. So not only, you know... And that I think, you know, it's not something that I've experienced film-wise, and I don't know him as an actor at all, which is, I guess, unfortunate in some ways. But I think more than anything, he has become the character that he plays. And I think that's the nicest thing about it, is because he has created a world for other people to enlighten them, to encourage them, to create positivity for them. And actually, he applies that to his own life. And that, for me... is the uppermost person you can find.
Exactly.
That creates such love and happiness for themselves, for their family and for their fans.
Mm. I think that's beautiful. Much love to family, friends and Chadwick Boseman forever, ladies and gentlemen. So now, let's segue into more reviews.
So, two more. Paranormal Activity
3. I want to end on a high with Paranormal Activity 3, so let's just go with Regression. I have hardly anything to say about it except one star. What a load of old balderdash.
I fell asleep.
It was awful.
I dozed in the last 20 minutes, honestly.
Laura took herself to bed.
I did. I was still watching it for a bit.
And I had to suffer for the rest of it. It was a good concept, awfully executed, terribly acted. Emma Watson...
Ugh. Dear, oh dear.
No wonder this film, because I turned to Laura at one point, didn't I? I went, this film went right under the radar, because it came from post-Harry Potter. No fucking wonder! Regression. Ethan Hawke. It's about a satanic cult. This young woman's been apparently abused, tortured. It's all lies. And it's the point focus of David Fulis is the psychiatrist who's in it. He's a main character, then he's not, disappears. Ethan Hawke basically creates this crime, and it basically says regression hypnotherapy is negative because it generates and encourages the imagination and causes regressive false memories. Bollocks. Bullshit. Hated it.
I mean, it made it its budget back, but only by...
$2 million.
Correct.
It was a bomb. It would be considered a bomb. Also, it took ages to get released.
Yeah. So, a one-star film. What a bunch of shit.
And it was directed by Alejandro. I think I recognise that name. I think he directed The Others. I don't... Yes, he did. And I loved The Others.
Luna. Don't you have that?
No, that's not. That's a different thing completely. That's Dave McKean's Luna.
Mm.
So, Paranormal Activity 3, we're going to go out on.
I mean, it's more of a high for you than it is for me, because I don't like it.
I just got, like, I get a weird, you know, kick out of films that really make you sweat. But really make you sweat, really put you on the edge, and that really fucks with your head.
Paranormal Activity 3 is, you know, the best out of the lot. It's just fucking tense, and, you know, found footage, mock documentary films are now in of themselves jokes and up for spoofs, and they, a lot of people view it as a lesser medium. Shulman and his co-director, of whom were famous for the Catfish documentary that now is a famous MTV thing. I love that they went from making a documentary about false identities to then, hey guys, you did a documentary, do you want to do a found footage horror? And then basically transcended from that and are now one of the most sought after horror directors and thriller directors out there. They've recently just done a movie on Netflix, a big action film with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Jamie Foxx called Project Powers. It's just interesting to see that you've gone from these really small movies, you don't know where you are in your career, all of a sudden you get offered an opportunity, and instead of, you know, I bet they felt being offered Paranormal Activity, they went, you're only coming to us because we were successful with a documentary. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's as simplistic as these people think, but what they did was they evolved the found footage movie, the camera angles, the ingenuity, the executions of the shots. And I said to Laura whilst we were watching this, even though someone may get credit for the script and the initial like blueprint of the story and the characters, these types of movies are very directorially specific because of the execution, how you're going to use the shots, how you're going to use household items, things that are in real life, things that you are at hand. It is the ingenuity, the mechanisms of creating your own CCTV camera setup with a fan, like things like that. Also the usage of it, the panning, the slow takes, the fast forwarding. It is just so ingeniously edited and executed, and it is probably one of the most tense and horrifying supernatural films I've ever seen. And Paranormal Activity 1 is up there. Paranormal Activity, I don't know, 2, I don't remember that much. Number 3 is the pinnacle of those horrors. I think Blair Witch Project and Paranormal Activity 3 go hand in hand as the best found footage horror films ever made. Laura, I think, loved it to an extent, but at the same time, do you not get a kick out the end of it going, oh, it really fucking scared me, I loved it?
No, not at all. It bothers me. It sits on my mind.
Why did you buy it then and want to watch it? Because you thought you could.
To test myself, I guess.
Yeah. But how many stars would you give Paranormal Activity 3?
It's kind of difficult. From a like,
experientially and emotionally, you're probably like, one star, one star!
From my point of view, I don't get the point of horrors particularly, and it's a one-star film. However, I can appreciate it's very well made, therefore 4 stars.
Mm. I'd give it 5. Ariel Shulman and... Can you get their names up, please? Because I feel really disrespectful for getting one of... Ariel Shulman and...
I mean, you asked me with the limited access to actually find something on the internet. That was really stupid. I didn't even put Activity. It'll come up, though, won't it?
Maybe number 1.
No, I put 3. I put Paranormal 3. I mean, it's written by Christopher B. Landon. Does that count?
No. Also, those writers of these types of films don't really add much. I mean, with the characters and all that, and the performances. And
Henry Joost and Ariel Shulman.
Joost and Shulman, that's it. Great, great. I'm really interested in seeing that other film called Nerve.
Jesus Christ.
It made a lot of money.
The budget was $5 million. It made $207 million.
Mm-hmm. And no wonder they went and did the follow-up, which made a little bit less. But I want to watch a film they did called Nerve, which is a little bit like Truth or Dare, or except it's like a social media satire on people doing things, pushing them beyond their nerve limit. It's like that game, Are You Nervous? Or except this is on like another level of... That's just creepy. So it's on that level of pushing themselves. So I'm really interested in seeing... I think it's Viral and Nerve by them, and also their new film on Netflix. Laura has access to the internet and I don't, so I don't know if I'm given the right names of their films, but I'm interested in seeing what else they do. They're really, really good filmmakers, and I'm happy that they were recognised and they actually proved themselves, that we're not just the guys who do documentaries. We can use that to our advantage to get an in and then branch out and make films that we probably initially wanted to make it from the beginning. So anyway, that's it.
Yes,
that from is articulate it. Warbling. Sorry that there's been a lot of pauses and a lot of.
It is nerve and viral. You're right.
I am right. Sorry if we feel like the episode's been a bit low in mood. I don't know why. Probably because the films we've talked about haven't really generated much excitement, or we've not had much to talk about. And Laura's not really feeling well. Hasn't been feeling well for a little while.
No, not really.
So anyway, we're going to cut this off before junkies start getting any louder. And we hope you're well and safe. And remember, be good to each other. And scratch your partner's back at night. That's very nice. Bye, guys.
Bye.
This has been It's Not a Rant, It's Articulate Warbly with Laura and Zach. How's that? How's that for a compromise, Zach? I have the old part of the show name and Laura and Zach. Or I can say, it's not a rant, it's articulate warbling with Zach and Laura. That is my terrible, terrible British accent. I think that's like a pirate with like crickets in his throat. I don't know. All right. Zach and Laura's part is produced and edited in Brighton, England. And the part where I just shove my voice in is produced in Portland. I also cut out some parts where like Zach and Laura are just sitting around lighting cigarettes and jangling teapots. And I don't add those sound effects. I don't add lighters being dropped from 2 inches from the microphone. That's all Laura and Zach and their amazing Foley work. I'm not sure if they're actually smoking or if they're just adding the sound effects. But that's all Laura and Zach. All right, thank you again for listening. And pretty soon we'll have a new t-shirt up in the shop at pgttcm.com. And for Zach and Laura's show, it's the icon of Laura and Zach. That's also the icon for the podcast. So yeah, check that out and help support the show. All right, thank you again. And there should be another articulate warbling sooner than later. And also check out Zach in the next episode of my show, Radio Free Oleander, where Zach plays the mayor. All right. Thank you so much, and thank you for listening. Rate and review It's Not a Rant, It's Articulate Warbling wherever you rate and review podcasts. Tell your friends about it. Be like, hey, I really like this experimental writer and his girlfriend in England. They talk about stuff, and they're awesome, and they're funny. Hey, you know what? I found about them on Dark Myths. Yeah, on Facebook. Oh, yeah, no, they also have a Facebook page called Articulate Warbling that you can join and find out stuff. And Zach posts things there, and Laura posts things there. And occasionally I post sweat-drenched press and sweat-drenched writ is where you can find Zach on the internet. And also, thank you, and have a good day. Be cool, be clean, don't be a jerk.